There was a time almost 200 years ago when you didn't have to go to school to be a scientist or an astronomer. You could just peer up into the sky and ask questions and you'd be an astronomer. Of course, there were a few telescopes then, but that didn't stop you. You could design and build your own. Or if astronomy was not your thing, you could start experimenting with nitrous oxide to be a chemist, using yourself and your close friends as the test subjects. As I said, formal schooling wasn't as important, but you had to be adventurous, creative, and determined, and above all, inquisitive and filled with wonder. This was the world of science during the Romantic era, the late 18th to early 19th centuries. It was time before the word scientist was used. Instead, they were called natural philosophers, and there was no divide between the arts and sciences, and both were united in their sense of wonder, the wonder of the world around them. The science inspired the arts, and the arts inspired the science. They belong to a single culture. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about a new book called The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. It's not your typical science history novel. There's almost as much wonder in poetry as there is in science in the book. It's quite an interesting read. Let me introduce my guest, Richard Holmes, author of The Age of Wonder, which just won the 2009 Royal Society Science Book Prize. He joins us from London. Welcome to the show, Richard.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be aboard.
Thank you very much. It seems like anyone could have been a scientist back then if anyone with imagination or enough money.
That's true. They were an exceptional group of people, but the chemist Humphry Davy, he had 1 year's education at the grammar school in distant Cornwall, which is down on the bottom left-hand side of England. And William Herschel, the great astronomer, was actually a professional musician. He composed, you can buy his music, his symphonies on CDs to this day, but he taught himself astronomy. Mm-hmm. And so did his sister.
And they were not called scientists in those days.
No, it's a very interesting, the term natural philosopher really had been used since the formation of the Royal Society itself around the 1660s. And what happens during the period that I'm studying is that gradually scientists becomes more professional. And there's a very interesting meeting of an entirely new body towards the end of the book. This is in 1833, called the British Association for the Advancement of Science. There's, of course, an American one now. And they had a great debate about what they should call themselves, because natural philosopher no longer covered it. And somebody produced the word scientist, at which there was an appalled silence because people said, it sounds like atheist. Hmm. And there's a debate we're still having today.
Mm-hmm. We certainly are. 1-800-989-8255. Talking with Richard Holmes, author of The Age of Wonder, on Science Friday from NPR News. I noted from note from your biography that you have written lots about this era. What attracts you so much to this period of time?
Yeah, I mean, it is fabulously rich. I've written, I don't know, a dozen books or so, but they're of this period because everybody seems so alive, they're so hopeful. And there is this extraordinary exchange. You know, the poets read the latest scientific papers. In that little conference we were talking about just now where the word scientist was created, one of the people debating that, and he was with the best young scientists of the day, people like Michael Faraday, John Herschel, and so on, one of the people was the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge of Kubla Khan fame. And he has a very important part in that discussion, saying that the naming is key because it's bringing together a number of disciplines, mathematics, botany, chemistry, which had never been brought together in quite the same way under this new term, scientist.
Did they just think, you mentioned the name of your book is The Age of Wonder. This allowed them just to wonder and think about the world around them at that point, and as sort of a stepping off point, because that's what they were doing as philosophers and poets.
Yes, I think what's actually, it's the great age of experiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, Humphry Davy, I was talking about, the young man from Cornwall. I mean, his first job, he works, he's so young, he's 20, 21. He's working in an experimental institute in Bristol, in the west of England, great seaport there, called the Bristol Pneumatic Institute. And what they're doing, very simply, is that they've discovered that the air is composed of various gases, and they're what they call artificial airs, artificial gases, including what we now know as carbon monoxide or nitrous oxide. And Davy, young Davy, had the not unreasonable idea that if you could make these gases purely and get people to breathe them, they might cure terrible diseases like, for example, lung disease, tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And there is an extraordinary period in his life. He sets up this laboratory. He has volunteers to come in to breathe the gases. He himself always tests them first. He virtually kills himself with carbon monoxide. I've had the laboratory notes in front of me, and there's an extraordinary moment where he writes in it, he's choking, and he writes, "My pulse is 100, and I think it's 140, but I do not think I shall die." So he wrote that at the moment that was happening. And among his, again, among the people he was testing these gases out on was Coleridge and also the poet Robert Southey, a number of the young intellectuals at that period. So there was already this tremendous crossover between the disciplines.
But they were also, he was also having a lot of fun with nitrous oxide, laughing gas, wasn't he?
Yes, that's an extraordinary story. It's one of the artificial gases he manages to isolate. And he realizes quite early on that it has euphoric effects on people. Imagine Coleridge coming from taking opium to breathing nitrous oxide. Very, very interesting. The laboratory notes that Davy records. Not quite Kublai Khan, but some very interesting lines about this. But the nitrous oxide, this leads on to a very interesting theme, which goes through the book. Because Davy realizes that not only does it have euphoric effects, but it has potentially an anesthetic effect. It starts when he takes it while he's got toothache. And he suddenly realized this could have very much wider application. And in fact, he writes and publishes a paper within which he says this could be used as an anesthetic in surgical operations.
Wow.
Now, there was no concept of anesthesia. Now, doctors actually, I looked at the papers at the time, thought pain in operation when you were having a leg amputated was positively good because it helped the human body heal. It reacted.
Hmm.
So this was an entirely new concept.
Wow.
Go on, yeah.
I have to break in because we have to take a break, but it's a fascinating story. We'll get back to it and have you read some of the poetry for the book, okay?
Take a deep breath.
Take a deep breath. We'll actually have some poetry that Sir Humphrey Davy wrote while he was on nitrous oxide. So stay with us, talking with Richard Holmes, The Age of Wonder. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday on NPR News. I am Ira Flatto, talking with Richard Holmes, author of The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. And we were talking about, the Romantic Generation of the poets, hanging out with the scientists of the time, correct?
That's right.
They were hanging out with them. Basically, what you're saying, we were talking about Humphrey Davy and his breathing nitrous oxide and basically passing the pipe around, so to speak.
Well, yes, it was a bit more scientific than that, but I like the image. And I have to say, I've written a radio play where exactly that happens. But let me just continue.
Sure, please, a great story.
It is a great story because there's a kind of philosophical implications. There are wonderful letters that Davy and Coleridge write to each other about the nature of pain. Why does the human body suffer pain? Mm-hmm. Is it God's plan that there should be pain when a woman is in childbirth? And so on. Very, quite profound, difficult questions. But at the same time, there is a tragedy here because Davy breaks off these experiments for actually emotional reasons. In short, he falls in love with his boss's wife in Bristol. And he realizes that he cannot go on. He would probably destroy the reputation of the institution. And he leaves and goes to London. He abandons this line of research. And you must imagine, this is in the Napoleonic Wars, okay? It's this period. The number of wounds and amputations were going, terrible human pain. And if only he developed that line, think in terms of what that would have prevented in terms of human suffering. And in fact, anesthetics are not really discovered until the 1840s, and in fact, in America, I think it was a chap, Thomas Morton, in the Massachusetts General Hospital, used anesthesia to amputate. So 40 years were lost.
Well, could that be, as the theme of your book points out, could that be actually a follow-up? Because these were not scientists, right? They were not looking for something to stop pain. They were just fooling around with the stuff. Had they been scientists of a later generation, perhaps they would have gotten to 1840. Would that be fair?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, science is a kind of, I call it, it's like a baton. It's a relay race. Mm-hmm. And there has to be the right moment. And this is very interesting. Was one of the reasons simply that he didn't have the right equipment to go through with this? Mm. Or was it like a conceptual, a cultural problem? People just didn't believe that you could have pain-free surgical operations. So that's a very interesting question. And while doing it, there were various ways he tested human reactions. And one was on himself. He wrote a poem while under the influence of nitrous oxide. Do you want to hear
it? Sure, please.
Okay. It's called On Breathing Nitrous Oxide. The form is very curious. Not in the ideal dreams of wild desire have I beheld a rapture-waking form. My bosom burns with no unhallowed fire, yet is my cheek with rosy blushes warm, yet are my eyes with sparkling lustre filled, yet is my mouth replete with murmuring sound, yet are my limbs with inward transport thrilled and clad with newborn mightiness around. Now, not very good verse, but actually physiologically,
yeah,
very, very accurate.
Yeah,
it's
a good description.
And in his laboratory notes, he says when he storms out, when the mouthpiece drops from his, he thinks he's like got giant powers. He is newborn. And this relates to a whole area which we'll finish up with the novel Frankenstein.
Mm. I have a caller who would like to ask about that. Let's go to Rebecca in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I recently reread Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I'm kind of wondering about your opinion about her condemnation of science, maybe man's ego, too much involved in science. But I believe actually her husband's science saved her life because she almost bled to death during her pregnancy. And he knew enough to put her in a bathtub of maybe water or something to stop the bleeding. So I'd just see what your comment is on that.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Yeah, very, very good. Well done, well-placed question. Yes, Mary Shelley, the young wife of the poet Percy Bysshe Shelley, she wrote Frankenstein in 1880. And I'm able to show that she actually first, very young woman, it's so remarkable, she attended a series of science lectures. And they're also, I'm able to show, they were actual experiments going on in London rather earlier, particularly by an Italian called Aldini, where he took executed criminals and attempted to bring them back to life using electricity. So she was looking at all this, and she had the reaction that it was a terrible threat to mankind. But her husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, was always an enthusiast. He owned a microscope and a telescope, and he followed the work of another figure very important in this book, William Herschel, who discovered the seventh planet, Uranus, and also established that there were galaxies outside the Milky Way. And Shelley reads all this, puts it into his poetry, and also, interestingly, writes really furious atheistic statements saying that this big universe shows there is no God out there. Again, a debate we're having now. I think Professor Richard Dawkins would recognize this.
Right. And that must have caused some stir, I would imagine.
Caused tremendous stir, just as it does now.
Yeah.
And after all, Shelley was actually kicked out of Oxford University for writing atheistic statements. But he was very passionate about science, knew a lot about it, and it appears a lot in his later poetry, both chemistry and astronomy.
Talking with Richard Holmes, author of The Age of Wonder, excellent, excellent book. I highly recommend it to you. It's just filled with it really fills in a period we don't know much about but are fascinated about the interplay between science and the arts and the poets and how one inspired the other. For example, you have a poem in your book by Keats who was inspired to write this poem when Herschel discovered Uranus. And it was,
That's right.
And Keats was around at the same time of the discovery of the planet.
He was a younger generation, but he was studying. He was a medical student. People forget this. He had a scientific training. Mm-hmm. He was a medical student in London, and he was given a book of astronomy as a prize, an introduction to astronomy. And he read about Herschel's discovery, was very moved by it, and wrote really probably the first great poem of his life. It's a sonnet. It's called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer. Won't read it all, but just to set the scene, he says he's starting to read Homer in translation, And the effect on him is like a whole new world opening up. And then he compares it to two other things. One is Cortes, the great explorer, discovering South America and crossing South America and seeing the Pacific. And the other is Herschel seeing the new planet. Here's a couple of lines from, this is from John Keats on first looking into Chapman's Homer. "Then felt I like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortes, when with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien." Wonderful image there. And there, this is a poem about romantic discovery. The book indeed follows a number of explorers, noticeably James Cook and Joseph Banks. Mm-hmm. But Keats brings it together in those two comparisons, that the daring geographical exploration and the exploration of the skies. And that is very, very important to him, as to many other writers.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. Let's see if we can get a call in here from Peter in East Lansing. Hi, Peter.
Hey, very interesting show. I'm very excited to, looking forward to reading the book. You mentioned William Herschel. Was it he or John Herschel who invented the cyanotype and was part of that circle with Julia Margaret Cameron, the photographer, and Alfred Lord Tennyson? That may be in a later period of the time period that you're dealing with, Mr. Holmes, but any insights that you can share with us about that interaction between photography and visual and the poetic arts and so forth, those characters I'd appreciate.
Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, again, very, very good connection you made there. John Herschel, Sir John Herschel, was the son of William Herschel. And as you say, exactly as you say, he was an astronomer. He worked in many areas of science, and he was involved with these early forms of photography. And as you rightly say, he was a great friend of Julia Margaret Cameron. And some of you will know there's this wonderful photograph of him in old age, John Herschel, with this kind of corona of white hair, like himself, like a comet. And he becomes this kind of symbol, the image of the Victorian scientist, just like Einstein becomes, you know, yeah. Einstein on his bicycle with his tongue out becomes the symbol of the modern scientist. That connection, if I can just expand for a moment on that, William Herschel himself, besides his astronomical work, he did actually discover infrared rays. Indeed, I think there's a new telescope being put up. I'm not sure if it's not called the Herschel, uh-huh. which is using infrared uh-huh. rays right now, actually. He worked with his sister, Caroline Herschel, very important, the first really important woman scientist, actually got a state salary at one time. And they were a brother and sister team. And then this is something I'm very interested in. What's the emotional impact of doing obsessive hard work, you know, night after night and so on? And that team is split up because William marries and his sister is forced to live away from the observatory. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a break in the family produced by the scientific work. But then I follow this through. William has one son, little John Herschel, and it's Caroline, Auntie Caroline, as she becomes, who actually teaches the little boy all his early science and stays a friend with John for life. The wonderful letters. Caroline lives until she's 90, and she's still writing letters to him, and he is still sending her the latest result of his research. So there's a very interesting scientific dynasty there going on.
1-800-989-8255. Bertie in San Francisco. Hi. Hi, Bertie.
Hello. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Good. Well, it seems to me that in previous generations of scientists, I think of scientists like Newton, who looked at kind of the division between religion or metaphysics and science as kind of like the division between that which we can measure with the senses and that which we can't. And I'm interested in this spot that you point to in which Shelley says, this great universe proves there's no God. Somehow, suddenly, all that can possibly exist has to be able to be measured with the senses. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about that point.
Good question. When did it morph from one to the other?
Yeah,
and it's
a very good question.
What was the cause of it?
It's a major theme in the book that when it begins, on the whole, everybody believes, in a designed universe, what we now call intelligent design, and that more discoveries just show the power of the creator. Gradually, as science becomes more accurate, more measured, a more humanist approach is revealed. And there are great debates about this. We think this began with Darwin and evolution. It didn't. It began in the Romantic period. And on the one hand, you the Duke of Bridgewater, a splendid Anglican aristocrat, he pays for a number of treaties. They're called the Bridgewater Treaties, which are in each discipline. A leading scientist defends the fact that they prove that there was a divine creation. Now, many scientists wouldn't write those treaties, but people found it very difficult to divide their faith from what was happening in, say, geology and astronomy. And very few people were as outspoken as Shelley was. Byron is a very interesting case in point, who is also fascinated by science. Again, this is overlooked. Scientists appear in his great work, Don Juan. I might read you a tiny bit about from that. But he, too, he looks through Herschel's telescope. And he has a wonderful response. He looks through it and he said, having seen the galaxies, it seems to me that mankind's pretensions may be somewhat overrated.
Talking with Richard Holmes, author of The Age of Wonder, on Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. I wish we had a lot more time to talk about all the characters in here. One of my favorite is the person you start off in the book, Joseph Banks. He sort of kicked off the whole era that you speak
of. He's a lovely guy. The book opens. It's almost like a movie. The opening shot is this young, bramble-haired, tall Joseph Banks, age 25, jumping off Lieutenant Cook's boat, the Endeavour, down onto the black shingle of Tahiti, the black sands of Tahiti. And he is a character initially out of another age. He's been educated at Eton and Oxford. He's privileged. He's moneyed. And he represents the old 18th century Enlightenment. But what happens to him on the 3 months of Tahiti completely changes him in the book, that he recognizes that the Tahitian civilization is something totally different to the European, that it's valuable in itself. He learns a language. He takes part in the rituals. And from being a kind of smooth 18th century botanist and collector, he becomes what we would now call an anthropologist and writes most movingly about it and makes great friends, and it changes his entire life. When he comes back, he's elected president of the Royal Society. He's one of the longest serving, possibly the longest, 42 years, and he becomes, if you can imagine, this kind of Greek chorus in my book, because he introduces, he himself finds so many of these young scientists, and as he ages, the younger scientists come up, and I'm very interested in what the effect is for a scientist growing old, seeing his work being overtaken, seeing wholly new ideas coming into play. Very interested in that.
Yeah, and because you mentioned this only lasts about two generations, this whole period.
Yeah.
Very short time.
That's right. It is very short time. It's exactly like the literary period, you know. And a lot of it's a time of warfare in Europe. And that's, again, very important because the scientists try to hold together an international community. This great, because the French are at war with the British, or the British with the French. But Banks and leading scientists in Paris continue their correspondence, continue to exchange results. Humphrey Davy, this is amazing, in 1812-13, the height of the Napoleonic Wars, he's given a prize, awarded a prize called the Prix Napoleon in Paris, and damn me, he gets it on a ship and he goes across to Paris at the height of war. He's given a special passport and he receives the prize. And there's a lot of humping and grumping in the Times back in England, and the French are deeply shocked. But he goes on to do experiments with gases down there in south of France and then in Italy, which eventually lead 2 years later to the miner's safety lamp, one of the greatest inventions and inventions that do good of this period, all through Davy's courage and the analysis of gases.
Wow, fascinating. Richard, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. You've written a terrific book. It's a great read. It's called The Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science. Author Richard Holmes, also author of Footsteps. Thank you for being kind enough to join us from London, staying up late today.
It's great. I'll get back in my balloon now.
Yeah, talk about we never got to the balloons. Next time.
We never got to the balloons.
we'll get there. Thank you very much, Richard. That's about
okay,
all. You're welcome. That's about all the time we have for today. Greg Smith composed our theme music. We had help from NPR librarian Keem Oleski. If you have comments or questions, write to us the old-fashioned way, Science Friday for West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Also up on our website, we have Flora's video pick of the week. The tomato blight. Late blight for tomatoes. An interesting flora has been out there in the fields. Also, we're Twittering and podcasting and all kinds of good stuff. And as I say, if it's going to be around on Wednesday in New York. We'll be at the new school and doing science face-to-face. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com for information. Click on the little icon that says face-to-face on the right side there. And if you can visit us at the new school in New York and be in the audience, that's great. If not, you can watch us online. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.